From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. When thinking about buying a house or even just reevaluating where you currently live, online maps can be a valuable tool. They can show you the locations of parks, transit stops, and schools, and a quick click can even show you where the best restaurants are located. Today on the show, we're going to introduce you to a new map, but one that can be invaluable when considering the safety of your home's location. It's a map created by the environmental group Beyond Toxics, and it shows the patterns of pesticide and herbicide spraying in our community. The organization's executive director will join to talk about this new mapping tool. Then, in the second part of the show, we'll get an update from the Register Guard about yet another board resignation besetting Springfield Public Schools. That's next on Oregon on the Record. It's a lofty claim in the organization's title, Beyond Toxics. For to imagine a world beyond dangerous chemicals is to envision a world radically different than the one we live in now. But to get even close to that point, one of the key steps is identifying where toxic chemicals exist and how we as residents can learn their location. Today on the show, the head of Beyond Toxics will join us to talk about a new mapping tool they've developed to let us know the location of chemical spraying in our community. Jennifer Davis, the executive director of Beyond Toxics. Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah. Why don't we start with this? The easy question is simply remind folks what the organization Beyond Toxics is. What do you do?
Yeah, Beyond Toxics is a statewide environmental justice organization based here in Eugene, working alongside frontline communities who are disproportionately impacted and harmed by environmental toxins. That could be air quality, water quality, contaminated soils, that sort of thing. And so we're in our 26th year, and we do everything from on the ground organizing to statewide policy and advocacy.
Okay. You recently published a map that showed pesticide use in the community. Can you kind of walk us through what that map shows?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the Ferns Pesticide Notification Web Map. Ferns is an acronym from the Oregon Department of Forestry. It's the Forest Activity Electronic Reporting and Notification System. And this map really took some a database that ODF had already available to the public that was a little bit hard to decipher. And we wanted to just make that more user-friendly for people. We get calls all the time from people who are really concerned about activities that might be happening around their properties. And this web map makes that a lot easier to navigate.
Okay. Does it, if someone were to go on the map, would they be able to see a particular area that is concerning with regard to the amount of pesticides being used?
Yeah, this is a great question. So we created the map so people could plug in an address. The first thing people usually do is plug in their home address. Mm-hmm. And it shows historical notifications of pesticide applications from 2014 to 2024. I will say these are notifications that are that were submitted prior to any actual pesticides going on the landscape. So this is what the plans were at the time.
Okay.
So you can go in and see, what areas around you might have had pesticide applications. You can see the types of methods that they were planning to use, the types of chemicals that were on that application, but it doesn't actually tell you exactly what happened after the fact.
Okay. I think some people might feel like, okay, a pesticide is sprayed in a particular area. If I'm far away from that, I don't have anything to worry about. Could you talk a little bit about the fact that, as I understand it, pesticides, it's not just direct application. Pesticides can work their way in all sorts of ways in the environment. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concern about watersheds, particularly rural communities, their drinking water. There are safeguards. Pesticide applicators are supposed to have adequate buffers around drinking water intakes, housing, schools, other sensitive areas. But they don't just stay exactly where they were put on the landscape. And, a lot of people are concerned with aerial sprays in particular, because that gets broadcast by an airplane. and drifts can happen, can and do happen. And so, yeah, it is, I think for us, really important for people to know what could be happening around them, just so they're more aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jennifer Davis, the executive director of Beyond Toxics. Well, I don't know. Are we, as a community, are we using less pesticides than maybe we did decades ago? I know awareness has certainly increased. Your organization does a lot of that awareness and education. Are you seeing any impacts in terms of less and less pesticides being used, or maybe even more being used?
If you look at the map from 2014 to 2024, it doesn't look like they have decreased. And I will say, this is, you know, one of the things that these notifications have are every possible chemical that the applicator might apply. And so it looks like, you know, there may be 50 sole pesticides on any one of these plots. We don't know exactly what's being sprayed. And I think with the, you know, the way that our agricultural and forestry use, we're kind of dependent on it. So, you know, I think it's really important for people to be aware of what's going on. There are other methods. There are forest landowners who, you know, use minimal or no sprays. So it is possible, but I think it's, you know, that is the less preferred method for sure.
Yeah, certainly too. Over the last decade or so, the publicity about a product like Roundup and its active ingredient, I think it's glyphosate, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but obviously there's been a lot talking about the dangers of such a chemical. And I'm not asking you necessarily a chemical question, but are you surprised by, there's all this information about health concerns, and yet, as I understand it, it's still widely distributed as a pesticide or herbicide,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And glyphosate is a great example. You know, Bayer, which I think acquired Monsanto a few years ago, was, you know, that's the producer of Roundup. Glyphosate has been taken out of Roundup, so it no longer uses glyphosate for residential use, but it, you know, glyphosate is still available on the market in general for, you know, licensed pesticide applicators. And it's really hard, the toxicology of these things, you know, they're often, the chemical components are often individually studied and not studied with the other surfactants and things that are in the actual bottle. So, you know, glyphosate's a great example. Glyphosate is, you know, a known potential carcinogen. It's not, that may not be the thing that people are super concerned about, but the surfactants are a known carcinogen. But, you know, being highly focused on glyphosate in general, we don't know exactly what's happening on the ground and people's impacts. And some of these chemicals are being sprayed in conjunction with other chemicals. They're certainly mixing in the environment. And that's where the real concern is. You know, we can study one chemical molecule in isolation, but that's not the real world. And we really do feel like this, you know, information for the public and getting them more aware of what might be happening is going to be the driving force to study these. You know, I think having potential impacts in the environment, especially when they're impacting communities, is not acceptable. So we just really want to make sure that we're getting that information out there and accessible to the public.
Well, and to that point, let's talk about the general public. And you know, people with their best intentions may not know the ways in which they might limit themselves and their family from exposure to pesticides. What are some things that the general public can do?
Yeah, this is a really great question. You know, some of the exposure is unknown to us. And, you know, we don't know exactly what's in our water. We don't know what's in the watershed. Even if we did, we don't know where the source point is. And so I think for our benefit, just having that information out there and getting people aware of what might be happening, certainly we can control what happens on our own properties. There are other alternatives that aren't these chemicals that could potentially have health impacts for humans. And so just being aware, you know, the easy chemical that you can pull off the shelf might not be the most appropriate for long-term health.
Okay. Jennifer, my last question for you is kind of maybe pull that out a little bit scale-wise? Because I know a lot of people might say, okay, that's great, but in terms of massive agriculture and industrial farming, you know, pesticides must be used or herbicides must be used. Do you feel like, and certainly in the title of your organization, Beyond Toxics, do you feel like in terms of large-scale agriculture and feeding a hungry nation, can we move beyond some of these more insidious and carcinogenic, perhaps, pesticides and herbicides?
Yeah, this is a really great question. And, you know, I don't know if we'll ever fully eliminate the use of it, especially when we're battling invasive species and other things that are just, you know, they weren't ever meant to be in this environment in the first place. My background comes from conservation, and I know it's, you know, it's a really useful tool in conservation to have this in your arsenal. Do I think it should be the only tool we rely on? No, I don't feel like it's going to be sustainable in the long term. I know there have been lots of studies on the nutritional value of agriculture and all of that, where it doesn't seem like this is probably the most appropriate or the best solution. But I think it's valuable as a tool in the toolbox and not the only tool that we always rely on.
She is Jennifer Davis, the executive director of Beyond Toxics. Jennifer, really appreciate you coming on and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now let's get an update on yet another controversy at Springfield Public Schools, the resignation of another board member. Miranda Sear, who is the education reporter for the Register Guard. Miranda, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael.
You really got the scoop talking recently regarding the resigned board member for Springfield Public Schools, Nicole DeGraff. First, remind folks what happened with her.
Yeah, so, you know, with Nicole, it was the May 26th board meeting. It was a special meeting that was almost exclusively an executive session. There was very little in public session, so it was not highly attended, of course. Mm-hmm. I was actually the only audience member, period. so it was a little
the glamorous
quiet
world of an education reporter.
Yes, it was a little quiet in there. Of course, I can't really discuss anything that happened in executive session.
Sure.
But when the board reconvened in public session after being in executive session, they discussed a couple of complaints and then passed resolutions to not hear those complaints any further for both of those. And then Nicole DeGraff, in that discussion, discussing especially the first complaint, she said she had a different perspective of governance and said she would be resigning on June 30th. At least to me, that was a very sudden announcement. And I think for everyone else, from what I've gathered, even Nicole herself, immediately after the meeting, she rejected my request for comment. But a couple days later, we did connect and I did have a discussion with her on the phone. And she said it was a realization during executive session that led her to that decision.
Yeah. And what else did she share with you on the phone?
Yeah, so we talked for quite a bit. She did say that this wasn't completely spur of the moment coming out of nowhere. This has been some building tension for quite a while for Nicole. She was first elected in 2023, and ever since then, she kind of has been the odd one out on a lot of different votes. They have, as a board, voted unanimously on plenty of discussions, but okay, more often than not, if there is a disagreement, typically Nicole is on one side versus the other. So there is a lot of split votes in Springfield Public Schools, maybe compared to some others.
What were some of the words she used about the board? Did she bring up the D word, dysfunction?
Yeah, so in my discussion with her, Nicole said that she had been feeling very upset for the past year, feeling that there was dysfunction on the board. Specifically, she used the D word, so to speak. And she called it a battle that she didn't feel like she was being appreciated fighting that battle to correct dysfunction, so to speak. And Nicole actually did say to me she was sorry for the role she played in any dysfunction on the board. So she did acknowledge that. And so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, and I know you've covered boy, this isn't the first, I would say to most people who aren't in those rooms like you are, surprise resignation, Heather Kwas Onset. Remind folks about what happened there.
Yeah, so with Heather, it wasn't a spur of the moment in a board meeting, so to speak. But I remember I did get a text message from Heather saying she was planning to resign, and she sent me her resignation letter. And that was also kind of a result of building tensions and very high emotion board meetings. And we've been seeing that at Springfield Public Schools for a while, just some arguments or tense conversations that have left board members and board meetings in general very, very tense.
Okay. The president of the board and other board members, have they made any comments about DeGraff's resignation or either what happened with Heather Kwas Onset?
Yeah, so I spoke with board chair Jonathan Light as well on the phone. And first he said he was appreciative of Nicole's service on the board, but he also did talk about there is dysfunction on the board, but maybe not everyone is claiming their role in that dysfunction as much as they should. And he also pointed out that he and Nicole obviously don't agree on everything, especially with government's roles and that sort of thing. They definitely have different perspectives of governance, is what he said.
Okay. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Miranda Sear. She is the education reporter for the Register Guard. Can you also remind folks some of the big issues that the Springfield Board is having to deal with? The budget issues, layoffs, talk about all that as well.
Yeah, there is definitely no shortage of new things happening at Springfield Public Schools right now. It all kind of stems from the superintendent resignation. Former superintendent Todd Hamilton resigned. He announced that, I believe it was in January, and then it went into effect in February. And so the board has been kind of battling with that. There was also a tort claim that was filed for an impending lawsuit filed by Todd Hamilton, as well as Assistant Superintendent David Collins. So there was already a lot of tension between administration and the board at that point, and that culminated, obviously, in the resignation of Todd Hamilton. So since then, they've been trying to find a new superintendent to replace Hamilton, and they have since appointed a acting superintendent. They will be soon appointing an interim superintendent who will be serving for the next year starting July 1. So they just announced three finalists for that as well. It's a busy board. There's a lot of meetings all the time. There's also the issue with the budget that stems, of course, from enrollment decline and just inflation in general, higher costs, things like that. And so there's a lot of things going on.
There really is. And I'm wondering too, you know, even if it's anonymous, but have you talked to some staffers, teachers? You know, is there a general, I don't know, mood amongst the people who work for Springfield Public Schools?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I actually spoke with the incoming president of the Springfield Education Association, the Teachers Union, and he told me he was actually one of the individuals who experienced a mid-year displacement. So he was moved from, I believe, it was one of the high schools to Hamlin Middle School.
Okay.
And he said things are not functioning very well. There is a lot of low morale amongst teachers. Teachers are frustrated, and they're not sure how they're going to deal with another round of potential layoffs. Of course, there are more layoffs coming for the school district, and the district has told me they haven't sent those out yet, at least not as of a couple weeks ago. They have not. So people are kind of still at the edge of their seats, wondering if they're going to have a job going into the 2026-27 school year.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, when you talk to the board president, is there a sense that they can kind of right this ship? Is it a matter of, you know, weathering the real budget storm? And certainly you've written about this sort of enrollment cliff that a lot of districts are dealing with, not just Springfield. But is there a sense that better days are ahead, or is it still kind of, you know, it's going to get worse before it gets better kind of a thing?
Yeah, from what I've talked with, you know, Board Chair Light and other folks, there is a sparkle of hope, seemingly. Okay. There's going to be a lot of new blood in general at the district. There's going to be a new superintendent, of course, interim superintendent. A couple other district leaders are on the outs, and there will be new leaders coming in for that as well. Obviously, there's going to be a new board member at mm-hmm. some point. Seemingly, we assume they have not announced that vacancy yet, so they okay. haven't started a search process. But, you know, things are changing at Springfield Public Schools, and Jonathan Light was hopeful that maybe that could be a path to maybe a new district.
Okay, okay. Well, maybe summer couldn't come soon enough to sort of reset. Miranda, my last question for you is, what do you think all of these impacts are going to be on the 2026-2027 school year in Springfield?
I think it's hard to say. I mean, so many districts are going through so many cuts right now, so many changes. There's not a single district in Lane County that hasn't faced some sort of unrest amid all the budget problems, enrollment decline, everything else going on. So I just think we're going to have to keep an eye out and see what things are in store for educators, students, families going forward, and how everyone can kind of balance out and manage with less, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll be asking you back as we go through the next school year. Miranda Sears, she covers education for the Register Guard. Miranda, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, you'll hear from the medical director at Oregon Health Authority about the concerning low vaccination rate among school children in the state. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.